Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road. We're streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us on facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking to Gerald Hausman and Bob Capone, who are co-editors of the book The Image Taker, the selected stories and photographs of Edward S. Curtis, who it turns out was as much of a literary and anthropological historian and writer as he was a photographer. So more on that a little later. Right now, I'd like to welcome Eve Brown Waite. She is the author of the book First Comes Love, Then Comes Malaria, How a Peace Corps Poster Boy Won My Heart and a Third World Adventure Changed My Life. Welcome, Eve, to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you. It's so much fun to be here.
It's great to have you. And you will be speaking tonight at 6 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore here in Santa Fe. And that's on Galisteo Street in their wonderful new location.
It's gorgeous. It's huge and it's gorgeous.
It's really great. So this is it's really a very sweet love story of you and this young man. Well, I guess you're both not quite as young as you once were, named John, who was your Peace Corps recruiter right out of college.
Yep, a couple years out of college. I wanted to do something meaningful, so I thought, oh, I could join the Peace Corps. That's a good thing to do. Even though I wasn't really sure if I had, oh, let's say if I had the toughness or if I had the gumption to really stick it out in a tough situation, but I thought, let me look into it and see what happens.
And so you walk into the recruiting office, this man talks to you, he's the cutest little thing, and you get married eventually.
I mean, yeah, it didn't work out quite that quickly, but in a nutshell, we eventually got married. But I knew as soon as I saw him. Well, it took an hour. An hour into the interview, I was like, oh my God, this is it, he's my soulmate. I have got to get this guy no matter what.
And you managed to do so, which is very humorously described in the book. Your first assignment was Ecuador, and it seems that although you definitely, as a young person, as a college student and so on, had a lot of organizing ability, you worked with, battered women's shelters, rape crisis, that kind of thing?
Oh, yeah, I did all that kind of stuff, yeah.
And that certainly, the requisite toughness certainly seems like it was there, but the idea of going to really rough places where there were all sorts of illnesses and where even the most minimal sanitation was not there was kind of surprising.
That was kind of surprising. It was tough. The circumstances were tough. The hardest thing is what you see. And it's just because a lot of the rest of the world has some really tough circumstances. And so when you're there, even though you're there to do something to help, you're living in it, you're mired in it, you're seeing it, and it's hard because it's sad, as it should be. It is sad. Their existence is sad sometimes. And so, of course, you're going to feel sad, but that's hard.
One thing that I found interesting was that there you were for in Ecuador, and there was some work laid out for you, but you kind of had to really find your own way. And I always thought, I don't know much about the Peace Corps, but I always thought that you plugged into an existing program.
Yeah, here's kind of a newsflash and a bit of good, helpful information for anybody out there who's going into the Peace Corps, which I wholeheartedly recommend. But be prepared. You've got to be creative. Some people, yes, are plugged right into a job and it all works and it's smooth and they're good to go. Most people, though, you get out there, you've got to make your own way, at least to some extent. Find your own job or find a niche or find some community project that needs you. You got to be pretty creative.
What did you do?
I ended up working at a church-run shelter for homeless boys. That's what I ended up doing, and it was amazing.
And some of the stories of these boys are very sad. I mean, the thing that got me, as I guess it did you, was these young boys, some of them as young as 5 years old, who were homeless, who were alone, because they had lost their parents, and there was no infrastructure to re-find your parents.
Yeah, this is Ecuador, and we're talking about 1987, 88. So we're talking developing world, but we're also talking a time when there were not cell phones. It's hard for us to remember that. Certainly no computers, no internets. And most of these boys came from very poor families who didn't have phones. Yes, there were landlines, but most Ecuadorians didn't have them. And they didn't even have street addresses. And their parents, a lot of them, were illiterate. So if you're a lost kid in one of these cities, how do you find your parents? You don't.
And there was not even a police...
There was really no infrastructure for a lot of these kids to have help finding their way home. Because if you can't go to a police officer and say, this is where I live, this is how you find my parents. Because a lot of these kids, they came from families that were migrant families. So the families were moving.
Yeah.
So you really couldn't even pinpoint where these kids' parents were.
It did make me think of the Red Cross and their work, for example, after World War II, trying to reunite people after war.
Yeah. I think it might have been a little bit like that. And ultimately what I ended up doing was trying to reunite some of these boys with their families. And that was just an amazing experience.
And, of course, there were some abusive families as well.
Yeah, oh, yeah. You know, we didn't bring all the boys back to a happily ever after ending. But a lot of times we just wanted the parents to know where the boys were. Even if the boys then stayed with us, at least the parents knew their sons were alive. They were being taken care of, and that felt like good work to do.
So you didn't make it through the full 2 years of Peace Corps service in Ecuador, and I guess if you're trying to see yourself as the tough peace warriors or whatever.
Good term.
It's a disappointment and a sense of failure not to make it through the whole 2 years.
I was devastated. I mean, there's a reason why I didn't make it through. I was medically evacuated or medevaced. It's pretty traumatic and a little dramatic. But yeah, when I got back to the States after a year, I felt like a failure and I was pretty hard on myself. Plus, let's also remember that I was in love with the Peace Corps recruiter.
Who was not in Ecuador with you.
No, he was not in Ecuador, although he did visit briefly.
Right.
And he was like, rah-rah Peace Corps. Not only had he done his 2 years, he extended for a third year. He was so good at it. So I was kind of afraid that our relationship was not going to survive that.
Because you wouldn't have made the cut, so to speak.
Yeah, I wasn't this wonderful, peaceful warrior, as you say. You know, perhaps he wouldn't see me in the same light anymore.
But you went back, and you did get married, and the next thing you know, you're in Uganda.
Yeah, the next thing you know. And I'm not sure if I actually said it out loud, but at least I implied there was sort of quite a number of years of, how do I say it, of me wooing the recruiter, like, really, marry me, really, really, I'm the girl of your dreams.
I thought he was supposed to woo you.
Yeah, well, it went both ways. But I, you know, like I said, I just knew from the moment I laid eyes on him that this was the guy.
He's here in the cafe,
yes,
ladies and gentlemen, and he looks exactly like you
yes.
described in the book.
And we are celebrating our 18th anniversary on this trip, so I was right, he was the guy. But either I said it or at least I implied that, honey, if you marry me, I will follow you to the end of the earth. And 2 years into our marriage, I got to actually prove that because he got offered a job that was, I think, two or three exits past the end of the earth.
Which was?
A place called Arua, Uganda.
Now, there's Uganda, but then there's Arua,
yeah,
Uganda.
Like exactly.
Even Ugandans were saying to you, what in the world are you doing in this place,
yeah,
Arua?
Yes, they were saying, you're not going to go there. You can't go there. And they actually, one person actually said to me, black people live there. You can't go there. As I looked in the face of this black person, and I said, what do you mean? She said, they're uncivilized up there. You can't go live there. They're uncivilized. And that's where we spent 3 years.
So what were they, if not black?
Oh, they were brown. This woman explained it to me. She said, we are brown down here in the north part of the country. They are black. Go figure.
You know, it's just racism is just crazy. It happens everywhere, and it happens along color lines that are sometimes undetectable.
Yeah. And actually, you know, I write about this a little bit in the book, and it really was an interesting lesson for me and for John and for other Americans to learn. Racism is everywhere.
You had black friends saying that only white people can be racist.
Yeah. And I was like, I gotta write and tell you about this. Wait till you hear about this.
So what did you actually do in Uganda?
We were there because of my husband's job, and he worked for CARE, which is a wonderful development organization, and he was doing economic development, micro-lending, micro-financing. And I followed him as I said I would. But I also had this background in public health, and I had been working for a number of years, specifically in HIV/AIDS prevention. And Uganda had a really big problem with HIV/AIDS at the time. So I thought, bingo, I will find a job, no problem. What I didn't know was how far out my husband's posting was and how really removed we were going to be from anybody who was doing anything. So it actually took a while for me to find any work to do. It was pretty frustrating for
me. What did you end up doing there, besides getting sick, which we'll get to in a moment?
I had a baby. And I also did some freelance health as well as AIDS education work. And that was good. And I started the beginning of writing this book, actually.
So you got pregnant there, and it was kind of a long journey to discover whether you were pregnant.
Yeah.
I love the section where you brought these little pregnancy detection sticks and then didn't know how to use
them. Yeah, exactly. I didn't know how to read the results. Because I also want to remind people, this is way before the age of when you could go into the CVS and buy one and go home and follow the instructions and know if you were pregnant. These were the pregnancy detection sticks that I had basically stolen from the hospital where I used to work, and they didn't come with handy-dandy instructions because presumably your healthcare provider would know how to read them. And here I was in the jungle with no healthcare provider, and I had no idea what it meant. And I went to my local healthcare provider, and he had never even seen such a thing.
Because he'd been working in the bush for years.
For 10 years. And I said, well, how do you know if women here are pregnant? And he said, well, by the time they get to us, everybody knows they're pregnant. It's like, oh, yeah, okay.
And so you had a rough pregnancy with not only symptoms of pregnancy, but you also got dysentery.
I got dysentery early on in the pregnancy, and I got my very first case of malaria very early on in the pregnancy. I was not a joyful, happy, glowing pregnant woman. No.
I can't exactly quote it, but there's a part where you say, in Uganda, pregnant women will be nursing toddlers, hoeing the fields, and carrying large stacks of woods on their heads.
Exactly.
Sometimes at the same time.
All at the same time, and never once complaining. Me, I was just complaining. That's what I did full time.
So let's talk about malaria for a moment. The book is called First Comes Love, Then Comes Malaria. We're talking to Eve Brown Waite, who, by the way, will be speaking tonight at 6 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore here in Santa Fe. Malaria. What is malaria?
Malaria is a disease that is caused by a parasite that is carried by just a couple of specific mosquitoes. We don't have them here in America, so most people really never have to be concerned about getting malaria here. But much of the developing world, certainly the tropics and the subtropics, do still have malaria. And actually, I believe, I don't want to say the wrong thing, but I know that it kills more than 1 million people a year, mostly in sub-Saharan Africa, a large number of them children under 5.
And what are the treatments for it? What kind of treatments did you get, and what kind of treatments do ordinary African people who contract malaria get?
Well, there's two different kinds of malaria. There's a kind that will not kill you, but it can stay in your blood for the rest of your life, so you do want to treat it, even if it's not going to kill you. Because you'll continue to get symptoms your whole life.
So that's one strain of the...
One strain. But another kind can kill you because it can attack your brain. And it can kill you. And in fact, it does kill a lot of people. However, there's wonderful treatment for it. And it's available, widely available, even in Africa. The caveat is you have to have access to health care. And not a lot of money, but enough money to get yourself to the doctor and to pay for the pills. There's a number of different pills for it. And people do die all the time because either they don't have access to health care or they can't afford to pay for even the simple test and the simple treatment that will cure them. And so people die, and it's really heartbreaking because it can be prevented and it can be treated.
So this is something you dealt with on more than one occasion.
Yes. Both my husband and I both had numerous attacks of malaria.
Yeah. Uganda is a place when people talk about it, they think, what, AIDS, Idi Amin, massacres, horror, orphans.
Yeah.
You also saw the incredible beauty and hospitality and friendliness of people there.
It's a beautiful country. Many people don't know that. It's in the eastern part of Africa. It straddles the equator. It has a beautiful climate. Everything grows. It's green. It's lush. It's not like dry sub-Saharan Africa that a lot of people think of. The people are, for the most part, incredibly friendly and joyful. But yes, they do have a history of some awful stuff. Idi Amin, they were considered the epicenter of the AIDS epidemic in the late 80s, early 90s. So they certainly have had, and still now, there's a civil war that continues, that affected us when we lived there, that continues to rage in the northern part of the country. So you hear about a lot of kids orphaned either by the war or by AIDS. You hear about this war from Sudan spilling over into the north of Uganda. And so, yes, that goes on. And there's incredible beauty and incredible joy and incredible hope. Yeah.
How long did you live there?
3 years.
And when you came back, what was your life like?
You know, the subtitle of the book is How a Peace Corps Poster Boy Won My Heart and a Third World Adventure Changed My Life. And certainly this 3 years in Uganda changed my life. But I do have to say it's misworded because I feel like that 3 year adventure opened the door and led me into the life that I was always meant to have.
Which was
to know this other parts of the world that are so incredibly different from America that we may think of as having incredible hardships, and they do, but they also have incredible joy. And I feel like my role was to go there, live there, contribute whatever I could while I was there, but mostly to learn about what their life was like, and then to come back and share that with Americans who, for the most part, don't really get a picture of what that's like. And just to teach about it, to write about it, to talk about it, and to encourage Americans not to be afraid to go and visit these places if they have the opportunity and the drive, or to at least learn about it and say, how am I connected to those people, and what can I do in my life that might help the people who live in these far-off places that are really not all that different from me.
I have talked to Peace Corps volunteers who have returned from wherever they went, and one thing that they say often is, I learned so much from the people I was with in the place, and I wonder how much I contributed compared to how much that place and those people contributed to me. Okay, if you take that at face value, what good is the Peace Corps? Is it really just a big learning experience for a bunch of idealistic little 20-year-olds?
Yeah. I think there's two things in that. I think, yes, many volunteers will say, I got much more than I gave. And I'm not really sure if that's the full truth. In anything in life, we don't always get to know immediately the results of what we've done. And in fact, sometimes we never get to know. But be that as it may, yes, I do believe we are doing good as Peace Corps volunteers. Maybe not big, grand accomplishments, but a lot of small accomplishments. You encourage somebody to stay in school, or you teach somebody English so that later on they're able to go to university. Or you just open up a whole new view of what America is like. The rest of the world sometimes doesn't have a really accurate view of America. So I do think we are doing good. And just to talk about what my husband did, he was in Burkina Faso for 3 years, and he did many things, but just one thing is he planted a grove of mango trees. Now, that didn't mean a whole lot when he was there, but 10 years later it did, because it takes that much time. There was shade and food and fruit and nourishment in his village, and that's pretty important. But, okay, let's say that maybe what we do, the actual projects we're sent to work on, maybe for some of us they're negligible and we don't do that much good in the moment. Learning about the rest of the world and bringing that back to America, I believe, is a huge contribution, not to the rest of the world, but to America. I think there's a lot of Americans who just don't have a very big global view, who don't have a very honest picture of where America really fits in the whole rest of the world. So if we do nothing more, then are those ambassadors of the rest of the world back to America, as well as the ambassadors of America to the rest of the world? I believe that is huge and worth every penny that the U.S. government spends on Peace Corps.
10% of the proceeds from your book, First Comes Love, Then Comes Malaria, are going to an organization called CARE, which is the group your husband was employed by when you guys were in Uganda. What does CARE do?
CARE is a wonderful organization. They are in, I think they're in at least 30 or 40 different developing countries around the world, Africa, Asia, Latin America. They do two types of work, and one is immediate relief work. So they would come in immediately after a tsunami, after a hurricane, if there's some major crisis, and try to do immediate relief and rebuilding. And they also do that longer-term development work, like my husband's project, which is you go into a community that's essentially stable, and you say, what are the needs? And then they develop projects that try to meet those needs. CARE, and they've done all kinds of stuff like health and economic development and building latrines and digging wells. Their main focus at this point, as I understand it, is projects that empower girls and women, which is so important. Because if you work with women, what they found is if you do economic development projects that work with men, that's great, and it helps the men, and it will sometimes help the village. But when you do those same projects with women, you empower the entire family, and it benefits the entire village. They found that working with women has a bigger, a greater impact often than working with men. So they've been focusing on that for the past few years.
It is interesting how there's this worldwide, call it feminist movement or women's movement or whatever, that is having, it's manifesting in so many different ways, and one of them is microcredit and microeconomic lending programs.
Yes.
and grant programs like the kind you're talking about. And here in the United States, we have the situation where girls are really the valedictorians of their classes now, and so on. It'll be so interesting to see what the world is like 50 years from now.
Yeah, I agree.
We live that long?
Yes, I agree.
First comes love, then comes malaria. How a Peace Corps poster boy won my heart and a third world adventure changed my life. A memoir by Eva Brown Waite, and she will be speaking tonight at Collected Works Bookstore at 6 o'clock right here in Santa Fe. Thank you so much for being with us here in the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much. It's been such a joy. Santa Fe is just a fabulous place, and we're having so much fun.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
We're going to take a break right now. We'll be back in a moment. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Gerald Houseman and Bob Capone. They are co-editors of the book The Image Taker, the Selected Stories and Photographs of Edward S. Curtis. And they will be speaking at Collected Works Bookstore on Tuesday, the 21st of July at 6 in the evening right here in Santa Fe. Welcome, gentlemen, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.
Yes.
So Edward Curtis, a renowned photographer, many of his photographs of Native American people, not just in the Southwest, but in many places, are well known, these kind of sepia-colored images. But I did not know that he was also a writer and a collector of stories and histories of American Indians.
Actually, Edward Curtis was blessed because he had with him out in the field a gentleman by the name of W.E. Myers. And it was Myers, who was a linguist, who had a phenomenal ability to absorb and understand languages and translate those so immediately to Curtis that the two of them were able to just really hone in on and understand these people far better than anyone else. And they had a sensitivity to these people, and the understanding that the Indian peoples had toward them, it was a mutually shared venture, which made it really an incredible journey for everyone involved.
How did they meet up and put together this endeavor of recording the visual and story lives of so many people?
Well, Edward Curtis had a studio in Seattle, Washington. In 1898, he started to photograph American Indian people in the Puget Sound region. He realized, as many people, that they were losing their cultural identity and took it upon himself to photograph as many people as he could. So during the spring, summer, and fall, he went out and did this documentation. He had no idea that it would ultimately lead to the monumental project that it became. He was invited in 1900 to attend what was considered the last official Sundance that the Blackfoot people were allowed to, in terms of the U.S. government, allowing them to have their Sundance that summer. And he was asked to come visit and see that. And from that experience, he was not allowed to photograph at all because it's such a sacred event. But from that, he took this goal to try to photograph as many people as he could before he felt that they truly were a vanishing race. And fortunately, they didn't vanish, but certainly their life and lifestyle changed so dramatically that without his input, his documentation, and his photography, it would be a tragic loss for not only Native American people, but us as well as a nation.
There are, of course, as you just mentioned, events and rituals and so on that he was not allowed to photograph. And then there were also some groups that really were very conservative about letting them know about themselves, particularly their spiritual traditions. So how did they establish trust and really begin to elicit stories from people who may not have wanted to or had limits on how much they wanted to share?
Partly, you have to remember the time factor. You know, we're talking about, when Bob was talking about the Sundance, 1898, and that was a good long time ago. And Native Americans had lost a lot. They'd lost a lot in terms of their land and their rights, but they hadn't lost their ability to tell stories. And they enjoyed doing that. So part of this is storytelling, and there are always elders who are willing to share how they grew up. And I think Joe Medicine Crow makes a beautiful point in his introduction regarding that, because that, of course, was his grandfather, whom Curtis took the beautiful photograph of in the beginning of the book. And you can see the resemblance between the grandfather, can't you, Bob, between Joe's grandfather and himself?
Absolutely.
There's an interesting question that I kept wondering about, which is, when you do a project like this, you go around to really document a vanishing way of life, or a way of life that's really being compromised by the colonial powers that be and whatnot. You want to be able to keep yourself out of it, and yet it's impossible to completely keep yourself out of it. Where do you see Curtis's stamp on the work, and where do you see that he was most able to really let himself be invisible?
Well, it's a fascinating question, and the answer to that is really the man himself. He was truly unique. I always say, in simple terms, he was the right man at the right place at the right time to make all of this come about, because he had an uncanny ability. He was a large man in stature. He was 6'2", but he was very large. And he had a sense where most photographers, commercial photographers, were, you know, sought an opportunity to take a photograph of one of the famous chiefs, whether it's Chief Joseph or Geronimo, Red Cloud, any of the others. They seized that opportunity and basically took the photograph and ran, and then made as much money as they could from it. Edward Curtis had no vision like that whatsoever. It was truly his intent to try to understand these people. He didn't bring his camera out for, that said, up to a week or better before he even took a photograph. He lived with these people, got to know them and understand them, and the beauty of his work and the writings, which is what Jerry and I love so much, is that he tried to understand them, and the best way he thought he could understand them is if he understood their world and their vision and their creation myths. And that's what our book is, just has such incredible strength, because every volume, the 20 volumes of the Monumental North American Indian, documented a specific tribe or region, and each of those volumes talk specifically about the creation myths of these people, and that's what we found fascinating, especially Jerry, because that's his field. So that
well,
was wonderful.
Thanks to you, Bob, because you drew me into it so many years ago. I was giving a description to someone about how we had met, and you had that wonderful little studio off the plaza. And I remember going in there and seeing vintage photographs for the first time.
That's it. That's right.
Let's stay with creation myths for a moment. Gerald, when you look at all these creation myths, what are some of the common themes among the many peoples of North America?
Well, one of the common themes of the migration myths, of which we have many in the book, would be people having to cross rivers, having to cross bodies of water, having to leave areas that were stricken with drought, having to travel sometimes thousands of miles to get to a place where they could hunt, and also fleeing enemies. So all of these things factor into the storytelling. And why a story is universal? Well, we all share in those doubts and discrepancies and nightmares and holocausts, don't we?
Indeed. And it's fascinating, because there is such an interesting intersection between myth and history. So
yeah.
A lot of these stories are from real life. They're not kind of made up stories necessarily.
Well, no, they're not. And behind every myth is a true event. of one kind or another. And Bob and I have heard them spoken by contemporary storytellers where you're listening to a story and it sounds fanciful in some ways, but in reality, it's a man talking about his life, or a woman, or a child even. One of the things I thought I'd mention to you, and Bob's well aware of this as well, is that very often our trusted, our tried and true historians, people like Lewis and Clark, got it wrong. They saw something, they misinterpreted it, or it was written down by a scribe. It wasn't exactly what happened. And this did not happen very often with Curtis, because Curtis went back to the same place, in the case of Hopi, sometimes 7 or 8 times over a period of more than 10 years. Do I have that right, Bob?
Absolutely correct.
And he was given a nickname sometimes with different tribal members, and he was called the man who sleeps on his breath at Hopi because of his his air mattress.
Right.
But Lewis and Clark, in one part of our book, on page 79, actually, there's a mention of Lewis and Clark speaking about the Atsina people, who are the Arapahos, a branch of the Arapaho tribe. And Lewis and Clark thought they witnessed so many lodges, and I don't have the exact number because I'm not looking at the page, but Edward Curtis was able to reflect on what he had heard from elders, and there were many more lodges. In fact, he describes lodges as far as the eye could see from that period of time. And I think that's the glory of the book, really, is that it puts you back in a place when Native Americans were free to roam.
It made me think a lot about the question of scholarship and the extent to which Curtis's work is really used and respected by scholars. Are people really working with this incredible documentation project that Curtis and his associate did?
Well, what's interesting about that is that when the North American Indian that was actually underwritten by J.P. Morgan, the famous financier, when the first volumes came out in 1907, there was a tremendous, the question was, did Curtis have this right? Did he have, not only did he have it right factually, but did he have the right to state these things in a scientific format? And Morgan was quite concerned about the respect of his name and whether or not this was going to be a conflict. And so ultimately, there was a tribunal of experts that were assembled and reviewed the North American Indian text and found it to be, in fact, based on the scientific method and the processes and all of the work that was done ethnographically was deemed to be of high extreme value. And so with that, they continued with the documentation, although J.P. Morgan thought it would only take 5 years for Curtis to finish his work. It took eventually 30 years. It wasn't until 1930 that the last Volume 20, Portfolio 20, was finally finished. And it was a financial disaster from the beginning, but the end result is one of the greatest set of books that we could ever hope to have as a legacy of the Native American people.
You know, Bob, one of the things that you just reminded me of is the fact that when we first started this project years ago, you mentioned to me how scarce the books were, and although they're thought to be in many libraries, in a number of cases, in my experience, they're not there, or they only have a few of them. And you want to mention something about the small number of books that were actually published? How many books were published in a given year, for instance, when you did the Tewa volume? How many do you think were published in one volume? How many copies?
Well, let me give you some background on that. The original intent in 1907 was for Curtis to go out for 5 years to document all of these tribes and then have these photographs compiled into a 20-volume and 20-accompanying portfolio set concept. J.P. Morgan was going to limit these sets to 500 in number. It was to be on a subscription basis, and if you were interested in buying this, you agreed to pay $150 for each volume and portfolio as they were delivered, the total cost of subscription cost being $3,000. Well, this was an astronomical sum at the time, and it only appealed to institutions and wealthy art patrons. However, after Morgan died in 1912, the Morgan Foundation was reluctant to continue funding of the North American Indian, so Curtis had to scramble for the next 23 years to try to finish this work, and ultimately only 272 sets were printed, with the majority of those, in fact 85% of those, are in institutions across the country and about 10 or 12 of them in Europe.
We're talking.
Wow.
Yeah, it's incredible, which makes this book that the two of you have done all the more important. The book is called The Image Taker, The Selected Stories and Photographs of Edward S. Curtis, and we're talking to co-editors Gerald Houseman and Bob Capone. This is a monumental editing process. You have to choose among so many stories and so many photographs. How did you do it?
I'll talk about the photographs first, and then, Jerry, you give her your end of that as far as your... The North American Indian, in total, there were 2,200 different images. There were 1,500 small images that were in the volumes and 720 large different images that were in the portfolios. But it's estimated in the 30 years that Curtis took his photographic, or was taking his photographs, that he photographed 40,000 negatives. That's basically about 1,300 negatives a year, which does sound, after 30 years, to be a reasonable sum. But you have to remember he was using glass plate negatives throughout this entire project. It's a phenomenal experience to realize that in 1888, Kodak had already created the instantaneous box cameras, and gelatin roll film was immediately available, and virtually all of the major photographers abandoned those large format cameras to go with the small instantaneous handheld cameras that allowed for a shooting of the hip process. Curtis refused to use that. He used glass plate negatives, which obviously required a tripod, and that's an incredible factor when you're looking at any of his imagery, especially, of course, his portraiture, is that there's a sensitivity that comes through because these people had to become a willing participant in the process. There's a big camera stuck right in front of them, and what comes through is phenomenal. But what Curtis had to do to protect himself is he had to submit to the Library of Congress, for copyright purposes, two photographs that would then be registered and then copyrighted. Approximately the 2,200 images that are in the North American Indian are copyrighted, but there were over 1,600 other images at the Library of Congress that never were published in the North American Indian. And in the early 90s, I went back and did research at the Library of Congress, and when we did our first book, The Prayer to the Great Mystery, that book had many of the unpublished images, which since then have been used over and over again by other publishers and editors. So our book, this time, I took a photographic approach of trying to show imagery from the volumes of the North American Indian that have never seen the light of day. One of the problems with Curtis's work when you pick up a book is that generally you're going to see the same images over and over again, his greatest hits, if you will. And what our book has is a refreshing look at Edward Curtis's photographs that virtually have not seen the light of day, and that's what's exciting about it.
So that's the photographic end of it. What about the text?
Well, the text, as you can imagine, if you went to Rainbow Man and you petitioned Bob to let you take all 20 volumes home, and he was daft enough to let you do it, which in my case, you know, long-standing friendship, and he said, yes, I know they'll be safe in your studio. So I took them home, and the first thing I did was I set them on my desk, and they went from the desk to the top of my studio window. So I don't know what that would measure in terms of feet, but it was taller than the shoulder bone of my Great Dane.
That's a measurement.
That's the way I measured things, because we still have Great Danes, by the way, but in those days we had one big Great Dane who used to come into my studio, and he would just stand there and look at me with this expression, what are you doing? Because in order to read these books, I would have my face close up to the paper, And I just read book after book after book, and almost lost my eyesight. It was psychological, I know. I just began to see fuzzy little shapes in front of my eyes after a while, as you can imagine, reading. The books are quite thick. How many pages, Bob, in each one do you think?
Well, they do vary, but ultimately in the volume 10 and volume 12s, I think those are the largest. There's over 300 pages.
So to read each one of them, I can honestly say, and this is not in any way boastful, but I have not met anybody who read all 20 volumes.
Right.
Bob may be the only person. And so we're we're a league of two.
Well, what's fascinating about that is that the volumes are incredibly readable as well.
Oh, yeah.
We're talking about ethnographic information that when you tried to read Bureau of American Ethnology reports, you can't get through probably the first five pages without being lost or
trying to
figure out what's said. But
right.
Curtis's volumes were wonderfully written.
Well, he could write. And the neat thing about Curtis was he also could... He could tell the difference between a windy paragraph and one that was sparse and lean, and he wanted to keep the flavor of the storytellers alive, and so he reproduced what they said, probably very close to verbatim. And as you said, he had Myers, but he also had other, in the case of the Taiwan Tiwa, I think he had as many as four interpreters involved in that process.
That's
and
true.
And then he, of course, got the last licks and did the hardcore part of it. But I find his histories, to answer Mary Charlotte on that one, the histories are as interesting to me as the myths.
Right.
Because he nailed it. He really nailed it. And you get information on Coronado. You get information on the rebellion in 1680 and what happened at Zuni. And this stuff is priceless to me. I read it and reread it. I never quite get enough of it. And so I was very much taken with the histories. And when I was all done reading those books, I said, well, for one thing, we've got to include the histories. We can't just make this storytelling. We've got to have the histories because that's storytelling as well.
I tried
to match those histories with the stories that fit them the best.
The fact that the two of you have done this unbelievably laborious editing process is such a gift to the rest of us who are not necessarily scholars nor necessarily obsessed with Edward Curtis. You have to be one or the other or both to have even sought out this 20-volume set. Here you've given us this very nice, readable book, affordable book, published by World Wisdom Press, and this is, it's just available to anybody. Have you worked with a lot of Native people on this and gotten their take on it?
If I could just intercede on that, I had an interesting, a good friend of ours from the Pueblos. I was quite intrigued to see if the information from the volume 16 that Curtis did on the Rio Grande villages, how much they perceived it as being accurate. So I asked them if they would read the particular section on their Pueblo, and came back to me and said, whoever mentioned to Edward Curtis this information, they should never have mentioned it because this is quite relevant to our own village, which told me that he got it right. Someone, you know, really, it could have easily been told stories, and how would you know they're really true? But apparently he just got it right, which, you know, I respect what my friend said, and in that sense, very few people do read them. But on the other hand, it's good to know that it was factual.
You know, Bob, just to echo that same thing, do you remember back when we did the Prayer to the Great Mystery and the book came out? We got some attention, review attention for it, but to me, the thing that was the nicest of all was when those two girls in the state of Washington did a history report on our book.
Oh, yes.
And they wanted to interview us on the phone, and they did, and then they did a little film. It was a biographical film of Curtis and the tribes in their area that Curtis had photographed. And to me, the most interesting thing about that was that they went and interviewed tribal leaders, contemporary tribal leaders, in the state of Washington. And every single one of them said a similar thing. They said, it's wonderful to see these faces from the long ago days. It's what Joe Medicine Crow said as well. You're looking through a window at the past, and so many young Indians today don't know this past. And that's in my own story gathering profession, I've often been struck by the fact that the younger generation, including my little pup there, the younger generation really doesn't know these histories, and many of them don't know the stories.
The Great Danes are weighing in.
Well, that actually was a little sausage dog.
Okay. It sounded a little high-pitched.
The big bluffer.
Yeah, right. I find it interesting that, to have read in the book that there were a lot of people who sought out Curtis. It wasn't that he was just going around saying, hey, I want to hang out with you and take your stories and take your pictures. They were saying, would you please do this for us?
That's true. And you, what you have to do is put that in perspective, because Edward Curtis was very late on the scene in terms of a documentarian. I mean, we're talking about 1898. Many, many, many Indian peoples had been placed on reservations or had been put somewhere for, you know, decades. And so what's, again, intriguing about Curtis's work is that he did not want to photograph these people as they were the day he was there photographing them. It was his intent to try to photograph them as they were. This is where Curtis gets criticism, because people perceive it as being contrived or manipulated. In truth, every image was a complete, controlled, manipulated image, if you will, because he set that tripod up and put that camera on it, and so everything that was in front of it had to be what he wanted to be in that image. But to his credit, he photographed people as they were. I'll give you an example. When he photographed the Sioux, the warrior societies were no longer in effect, but the men that were part of the warrior societies wore war shirts, and you could only have a specific war shirt if you had gained this honor being in the society. Well, if you look at some of the photographs in Volume 3, you'll see the same war shirt. So the question is, what did he do? Bring that war shirt and these people just put it on? No, the truth was that one of the men did have his war shirt, and each of these men wanted to be remembered as being in that society. Mm-hmm. You have to understand with the Native American people, the items that they have as far as their personal cultural possessions, clothing, etc., they give away without much hesitation to other people in need. And so, you know, they may not have had their war shirts long gone for whatever reasons, but to be seen with that war shirt on let everyone know around them that they were a warrior, and I thought that was fascinating.
You know, Bob, that makes me think of the fact that sometimes interviewers say, well, these were costume Indians. And then I always remember going to powwows with my mom when I was a little kid, and those dancers were also wearing quote-unquote costumes.
Right.
But you have to understand that I think people are not going to have their picture taken while they're wearing shabby clothing.
Exactly.
I mean,
right.
If someone said, Bob, we're coming over to your gallery tomorrow and we'd like to take your picture, I'm sure you'd look nice.
Exactly.
And so these, you've got to also think of them as people, just people, like anyone. And someone's coming to take your picture. And as you said, Curtis was an impressive being. He was tall, he was handsome, and he had a gentle way of dealing with human beings. And people respected him almost immediately when they met him.
You know, unfortunately, we're running out of time and it's time to go, but people can continue this conversation at Collected Works Bookstore on Tuesday, the 21st of July in Santa Fe at 6 in the evening. And I want to thank you both so much for this wonderful book and for being with us here on the Radio Cafe, Gerald Houseman and Bob Capone. And Bob is also owner of The Rainbow Man at 107 East Palace Avenue. The book is called The Image Taker, The Selected Stories and Photographs of Edward S. Curtis. Thanks again.
Thank you very much
for having us. Thank you so much.
Jerry, take care, buddy.
Hey, Bob. See you soon.
So long. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR is streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, which means you can listen to the radio on your computer. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime. It means you can also listen to the radio on your computer after the show is over, anytime into the distant future. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org. Please don't call, because apparently the phone number that I usually have messages on is broken. So if you have called, please just email me instead, because I haven't been getting messages. Thanks to Cabby for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz.